What I started doing last week was, for this topic of neo-Darwinism, I thought we could use this 10 questions to ask your biology teacher about evolution, put together by one of the intelligent design scientists, one of the more well-known scientists in that group, Jonathan Wells, as kind of like a springboard for talking about some of the areas of potential weakness in that viewpoint that we can exploit. And I mentioned that we had, in our other Sunday school class, we had been looking at the idea of using questions as an evangelistic method to get you out of the hot seat, to reverse the burden of proof, to make them have to defend their own position, as opposed to us always have. Not that we're not willing to give answers if people ask us legitimate questions, but there's some issues of burden of proof and some advantages to asking good questions that will give you an opportunity to rather exploit their weaknesses as opposed to always having to defend your viewpoint. And this little 10-point outline of questions was kind of doing that. But as you look at those, some of the fleshing out what he's really hitting at may not be intuitively obvious right there just from the question. And so I was trying to use this and go through it and give some more background as to how we might use those particular areas that are laid out in these 10 questions. So I think last time we started out by looking at the origin of life. And can anybody tell me maybe just one point of what we talked about that you can point out that's maybe a problem? I know that was kind of a difficult topic, but does anybody recall anything that we said? Bob? Very good. Okay, so under point number two, Darwin's Tree of Life, we highlighted Darwin's expectation that there would be this, at the very earliest part of the record of life, in the fossil record, that there would be a single organism that evolved. And then as it diversified and went through time, there would be more and more species that would supposedly evolve, so diversity would increase and morphology would, you know, the differences between things would grow. There would be a big difference between, you know, bacteria and people with time. And so you get this cone of diversity was what the expectation would be. And the problem was that when you actually look at the fossil record, that's not what you see. What you tend to see is what Bob described as, like, for example, the Cambrian explosion, all the different major groups of animals, all the phyla, appear all at once, fully formed, without precursors that can really be legitimately tied to them and shown, okay, this thing evolved from this, this one evolved from this. It's just they all appear all at once, abruptly and fully formed, and then they stay in the record very static until they either disappear, become extinct, or up to the present, in the case of living fossils. And so, in that sense, the fossil record is a incredible failure at really fleshing out the expectations that Darwin had hoped to see over the, you know, last 120 years since his time, that the fossil record was weak. And he admitted that the fossil record was one of the biggest challenges, one of the biggest obstacles to people accepting his viewpoint. But he had confidence that over the subsequent years that fossil discoveries would tend to vindicate his viewpoint. So he had kind of a faith commitment that the fossil record would end up helping him out. And as it's turned out, it hasn't really become a very Darwinian-looking fossil record, even though people continue to say that the fossil record is a record of evolution. And what they mean by that is that you can see change through time. If you assume that the fossil record or the geologic column represents geologic time and geologic ages, well, you can go to what they consider the oldest rocks and find things that are no longer existent, trilobites. And then you can go up in the record and find mammal-like reptiles. And then you can go further up, supposedly, in the record, find dinosaurs, and then eventually people. And so change through time, in their mind, in their way of looking at it, is, okay, the fossil record proves evolution. But it can be looked at in different ways. And so what we want to do is turn it around and say, no, wait a second. What the fossil record really shows is something very different from what evolution would predict. Don't get me off on these little side issues that can be interpreted in various ways. You know, I can give an explanation for that too. And there are many other things that we need to talk about. The mechanism for getting from bacteria to people. What is that? We would critique that. But the big deal is this thing of stasis. Things don't change. In other words, the actual record that we have, what we can actually positively see, not the missing parts that we can tell stories about, but what's actually there, is stasis. You know, I can trace this clam from here to here, and it may vary within limits for however many millions of years they claim it is, but it's the same. It's not changing. It's static. But if evolution is this universal law that is changing everything, why are things in the fossil record so static? Why is it a record of no change? Why are things appear abruptly and then don't change? That doesn't sound like evolution. And that's what we want to exploit. And in the areas where the fossil record should be the most abundant, we talked about the shallow marine invertebrates, the things that are on the bottom of the ocean. 95% of the fossil record are those types of critters, you know, the clams and the brachiopods and the corals and the trilobites. Those things. It's not, you know, saber-toothed tigers and people. You know, those are the famous fossil things that get a lot of publicity, but 95% of the fossil record of the 250,000 species that we have are shallow marine invertebrates. Those are the things that get buried the easiest and preserved and become fossils, things that are on the bottom of the ocean. When you look at those things, so where the fossil record is the most abundant, that's where this abrupt appearance and stasis is the most conspicuous. Which you would expect, where the fossil record is the best, we would see more of these transitional areas, more of these intermediates appearing, but that's not where they are. And so so what you have are evolutionists who are experts in shallow marine invertebrates, people like Niles Eldridge or Stephen Jay Gould before he died, but they'll make their arguments for evolution on things like the hominids, you know, human evolution, because they're the easiest to tell the stories about. But they're experts on the fossil record, the parts of it where 95% of it is. Why don't they make their evolutionary claims and evidence on the parts of the record that are most abundant and where the transition should be the most clear? And those are the kind of questions that we would want to point out. So fossil record was one problem we talked about last time. We talked about the origin of life, the famous 1953 Miller Urey experiment where he supposedly, yes. Go ahead, give it a shot. The laboratory experiments that produced such a confidence that we're on the right track were not really mimicking what early Earth conditions would have to be like. In other words, it was a false setup. And you mentioned the trap, for example. We talked about the trap in the experiment so that when he ran the ammonia and the methane and the water vapor and these other gases that supposedly were in the early atmosphere, no oxygen, because oxygen wouldn't work. It would oxidize those developing molecules and destroy them. And we talked about how if there weren't oxygen, then there wouldn't be this conversion from O2 to O3, triatomic oxygen producing ozone. And if you don't have ozone, you have no protection from ultraviolet radiation. And so the rate of destruction of those developing molecules will be much greater than the preservation of them. And so it's a catch-22. You know, without oxygen, with oxygen, you get the destruction of molecules. Without it, you have no protection, so you have an increased rate of destruction. So that was a problem. The trap, the amino acids that were produced, the handful of them, get pulled out of the system so that energy is no longer zapping them. Because if he left them in the system, they would be destroyed and broken down into, you know, irrelevant gases. And so, again, like Anita said, we're talking about, or one of the things that's wrong with that is that this experiment doesn't really mimic the condition. Now, why were they so excited about it? Because they did get amino acids, and amino acids are the building blocks for proteins. So even the most meager, the most insignificant results are going to be touted by evolutionists as wonderful confirmations of evolution because they're already committed to it, they're already believers in it, and so even the you're not looking at it objectively in what they actually produced. They're just looking for any signs that we're on the right track, and that's enough to say, well, you know, we've done some great accomplishment here. And we're looking at it from the standpoint that, well, what you've actually accomplished is you've produced a few amino acids, but you're still light years away from producing the first living cell. And that's why there have been all these other admissions now that they're not very close to resolving this issue of the origin of life, which is so critical in their point. We don't want to let them off the hook, even though they try to take the origin of life issue and separate it from neo-Darwinism and say, well, Darwinism stands on its own. You know, natural selection, mutations and natural selections explains the diversification of life from simple to complex. And we don't even need to talk about the origin of life. That's another issue. Maybe philosophy or something else can handle that for us. We don't want to let them off the hook because what they're trying to do is explain everything in completely naturalistic atheistic terms. That's the purpose of neo-Darwinism in the first place. And so if they can't even get the ball started at the very beginning, then we're not going to give them that. We need to exploit that weakness and say, you know, this is a real weakness in your theory. You can't even explain the origin of the first cell. Why should I believe you when you tell me you can explain the production from a bacterium to a human being? And so we looked at some other things about the origin of life. I'll go on. Any questions about those before we move on? Miller and Urey. I think it's Harold Urey and Stanley Miller. That's what generally the textbooks say. They have continued development. You know, that experiment was kind of a lab experiment trying to test some ideas that a Russian scientist had put forward about what the early Earth's atmosphere should have been like, what they thought it was like. Another problem we pointed out was that the geologic evidence actually indicates that there's always been an abundance of oxygen in the early Earth. If you look at the rocks, you can see evidence of oxidation and the hematite and stuff in those early supposed rocks that are supposedly 3.8 billion years old and stuff like that. So atmospheric scientists and earth scientists have always kind of like, well, it looks like the evidence supports the fact that oxygen's been here, but the origin of life theorists, you can't handle there being any oxygen there, so you continue to say, we don't believe the Earth had oxygen, but the evidence is that there was oxygen there. So, but anyway, there are other experimenters that were doing things, and then people picked up on what Miller and Urey did. A guy named Fox tried to figure out, well, how could we have this buildup of these organic molecules to get the first protocells? And he did some other stuff trying to mimic maybe volcanic conditions where a little trap would have occurred that would have allowed these developing molecules to get condensed more and more, and there's abundance of them. So there are other people, and there's been a lot of work since then, people trying to to get this thing rolling, either with some type of replicating RNA or DNA or something to get the first cell that could then take off and natural selection could take over. Because you're dealing with chemical evolution here. You're dealing with, you can't have natural selection operating on these things yet because they're not living, supposedly. So it's got to be something that chemicals can self-arrange themselves by some natural law or something that gets the ball rolling. And it was so difficult, and it's been so disheartening, I think, that people have resorted to other speculations. And we mentioned Francis Crick saying maybe things evolved, chemical evolution took place where other conditions are present in another part of the universe, and then meteorites brought them to the Earth, and then evolution took off from them. I mean, it's just been difficult for them to realize the success that they've hoped for in that area, and so we need to continue to point that out. I think the origin of life is an important area. Well, let's move on to homology. Homology basically is the idea, and I showed the textbook, my son's biology textbook, high school and college textbooks will typically have one of the evidences supporting evolution to be this idea of homology, that because things evolve such that whatever came before it, the structures may have changed somewhat slightly, but you can still see the rudimentary basic forms are somewhat alike. So you have like a bat, which has a wing, but it's still got this five-finger type arrangement, and other vertebrates too. A whale flipper fin, and human beings, we have hands. So they'll put that little series of things in there and see how they're similar. There's similarities there, but they're not exactly the same. They've been adapted to fit their particular use. And so he points out the question, why do textbooks define homology as similarity due to common ancestry, then claim that it is evidence for common ancestry? Circular argument, masquerading as scientific evidence. What he means by that is there are some structures that, like the octopus eye and the human eye, those two creatures, humans and octopus, are not considered to have a close common ancestor. And yet their eyes are very, very similar structurally. So they call that an analogy. They say that's not a homologous structure. So they have a different name for it because they've assumed, based on their view of evolution, that those don't have a common ancestor that's very close. And so homologous structures are those that are interpreted as having a close common ancestor. You can see that it's simply a definition based on the assumption of evolution. And they use it as they please. Either, homology supports my view of evolution, or if I don't want it to in this particular situation, I'll call it something else. I'll call it an analogy. So he's pointing out the circular argument. But even getting beyond the circularity of that argument, there are some other things that we should be aware of about homology. And in evolution, it's the genes that are being selected, not the actual physiological features, not the arm itself. It's the genes that give the instructions for building that structure. And so we would anticipate that the same genes would lead to homologous structures. In other words, if we're looking at a gene that we can see has a similar sequence, the gene sequence is similar, and it both of those genes code for, say, an eyeball, and we would expect there to be a link between those two. There should be a homologous gene, in a sense. But what's actually being found is that some of these gene sequences are similar, but the structures that are produced are not homologous. For example, a fly's eye, they've been able to delineate the gene section that codes or provides instructions for that fly's eye. It's the same gene sequence that codes for the camera eye of like a mouse. So that's a problem because a fly's eye is a compound eye with many multiple multifaceted lenses. It's not really a homologous structure. And yet the same gene sequence is there that seems to be, leading to the production of those eyes, even though they're not homologous. So there's something fishy going on there, at least in that. That's just one example of the genes not really meshing with what's happening with the final structure that's being produced. Also, developmental pathways, the way things develop. You would anticipate if the explanation for these homologous structures is evolution, that there should be a similar development. For example, the gut of vertebrates, the internal intestinal, it's very similar in all the vertebrates. But it's thought to be homologous by everybody, but yet it develops from different embryonic cells in different vertebrates. There's that developmental pathways are different. It's as if you've got these little wrenches thrown into the system here and there that just don't match with the expectations of Darwinism. When you look at the gene sequence, and we learn more about that, as we look at embryology and the pathways of development, they just don't fit what we would anticipate if homology was really just this simple, okay, these things are similar, and therefore that proves that they're closely tied to their evolutionary ancestors were similar, they're close, and therefore we see the similarities, but with adaptations. The final thing that we should be aware of about homology is that the Darwinian explanation for similarity only works as if the mechanism is really sound. In other words, if they have a mechanism to explain that similarity, it doesn't really. Not that powerful of a claim to say, well, I recognize similarity between something, unless you can explain how it happens. And that's the point in contention. That's what we're saying. We don't believe your mutations in natural selection can do the job. We believe your mechanism is faulty. And so their claim about the similarity is not very convincing, because we can point to similarity that does not come from evolutionary development. And some of the evolutionists have even made that problem in some of the books that they've written. There's a guy named Barra who wrote a book supporting evolution, and he claimed that just like the development of Corvette automobiles in a similar way, he kind of used the analogy of the development of Corvettes, as you look at it over the years, as an analogy to evolution. First of all, those are designed. Corvettes are designed. Yes, you can see changes, but you can see similarities too. You can see the development of, the modern Corvette from previous ones. And you could develop a lineage. You could develop a phylogenetic tree, this evolutionary pathway of how you got from one to the rest of them. But the fact is, they're designed. And that's why, just because something has similarity, if you can't really explain it with a valid mechanism, it doesn't really say that much. And we've always said, and people even before Darwin recognized, yes, there are similarities, but there are similarities because the functions are that plan, that body plan, is well suited for the function. And so a designer would not be outlandish to say, well, the designer would utilize the same gut system in vertebrates because they all have to do the same thing. And so there are just a lot of things about the homology problem that we should try to be aware of and try to inform ourselves about, so that that claim doesn't intimidate people, because I think that's one of the arguments that they probably persuade a lot of high school biology students by when they show them those similarities and yet differences, and they persuade people, yeah, that sort of makes sense. It sort of fits with evolution, but they're not telling the full story. So that's homology. The next one on the list, vertebrate embryos. Some of you have probably seen Haeckel's drawings of embryos, and there's usually a chicken and a human and a lizard. And supposedly he's depicted that these things, as they're developing embryologically, they recapitulate or go back through their evolutionary development. And so you can see that, you know, human beings go through this stage where they have gill slits and so on and so forth. They have a tail like a monkey. And then as they develop, they lose all those features. But you can see that there's this link between their earlier ancestors by the way they develop embryologically. And the problem with that is, even though it continues to be put in textbooks as an argument, it's like homology. It persuades people because it has this, when you look at it, it seems to have this persuasiveness to it because of the appearances of it. But as the science of embryology has developed more and more, there have been more and more criticisms about this. And yet, I think because it's such a standard argument and it sort of, in a utilitarian way, supports the evolutionary program, it continues to be allowed in the textbooks. But a lot of embryology experts have discredited it from a number of different angles. The worst of which is in the late 1990s, a panel was of, you know, secular expert biologists was put together that was going to examine this issue. And they compared Haeckel's drawings with actual photographs of embryos in the different stages of development. And their conclusion was that this might become one of the biggest frauds in the history of biology, because it looked like Haeckel had just simply doctored the drawings and made them look the way that he wanted them to look. There just wasn't... Let me read this quote to you. In 1997, a panel of international experts systematically compared Haeckel's drawings with actual photographs of embryos. Summing up the panel's findings in an interview with Science magazine, one of the prestigious scientific journals, the study's principal author said of Haeckel's drawing, "It looks like it's turning out to be one of the most famous fakes in biology." And yet they continue to put that in those textbooks. Other problems besides this potential fraud situation is that embryologists have noted that Haeckel really simplified things too, because what actually happens is initially the embryos start out looking very dissimilar, and then they converge somewhat a few stages later, though not nearly as much as Haeckel depicted. And then they diverge again later. So he gave a very simplified view, saying that it's just a simple, you know, they're the same at the very beginning, and then they grow more and more divergent as they develop. And so that itself was a oversimplification that was not an accurate depiction of what was going on in the embryos. That is, in a nutshell, what we can say about the vertebrate embryos, and point out that by asking questions if someone tries to persuade us that that is a good evidence for evolution. Number five is Archaeopteryx. Why do textbooks portray this fossil as the missing link between dinosaurs and modern birds, even though modern birds are probably not descended from it, and its supposed ancestors do not appear until millions of years after it, according to their time scale? What Jonathan Wells is pointing out in saying that is that when you look at the rock record, the fossil record for birds, supposedly more modern birds, even more modern than Archaeopteryx, are found in rock layers that are dated older than Archaeopteryx. And so never mind the dates for our purposes, how do you have the ancestor of birds, or the missing link for birds, coming after more modern birds? And so that's one problem with that. He's saying that we should be able to point out to people. Another problem is that again, we're dealing with a situation where there's similarities to reptiles in this bird, Archaeopteryx. And there's similarities to birds. But that doesn't in itself, without that all-important mechanism that really can explain those developments, you know, the avian lung, the bird lung is very different from the reptilian lung, the heart design and so forth with lots of other features. The feathers themselves, they're not closely linked. They develop completely differently from scales. So there's a lot of these major morphological changes that have to be explained, the increase in information to get from a reptile to a bird. In Archaeopteryx's head, the major features of a bird. You know, it was a strong, you know, looking at the keel bone, it looked like a strong flyer. It was clearly a bird, but it did have these other features that were reptilian, like claws on the wings, although there are other birds that have claws on their wings, and it had teeth. But in the fossil record, there are other birds with teeth, and all reptiles don't have teeth. Lots of lizards don't really have well-developed teeth either. So you've got a number of things that kind of, you know, you can tell a nice story about it, but it's kind of like a mosaic. It's an organism that has several different features that can be perhaps identified with different groups of people. But there are other animals like that. A duck-billed platypus is an example. You know, it's got a duck bill and webbed feet. And it lays eggs, and it's a mammal. It's got fur, and it's got all these different features that you might associate with different types of vertebrates, but yet it's unique. And they're certainly not using it as an evolutionary icon to explain some of these features. And so I think it's because Archaeopteryx was found like 2 years after Darwin wrote The Origin of Species. It was found in like 1861. So they were looking for missing links there. You know, they obviously wanted to confirm what Darwin said. So when Archaeopteryx was discovered, just the historical, you know, lay of the land at that time, it was just right to say this is the missing link between reptiles and birds. And more people have criticized that. And even one of the bird experts at UNC, Alan Fiducia, who's a world-renowned bird expert, ornithologist, he's been a vocal critic of this whole idea that, you know, dinosaurs evolved from birds. He's always been one of the, when they go to somebody that's the opposite viewpoint, it's him. He's not a creationist at all. He doesn't believe in that, but he certainly disputes some of the claims that have been made. And as far as our Archaeopteryx goes, we just simply need to recognize that it's a mosaic. It's got features that are, you know, perhaps some of them are not typically bird features, but that doesn't disqualify it from being a bird because there are other animals that are like that that have various features. It's not unique in that sense. And the strongest features, the evidence for it, its feathers, its keel structure, the keel bone, and other things, its wings indicate it was a good flyer. It was clearly a bird. And so can't tell the kinds of stories that they want to about that without what they want to do, though, is they want to use it as an example of an intermediate form, because we've already said the fossil record doesn't show very many intermediate forms or transitional forms. So they want some, and they do have a handful that they use. And I mentioned this last week when we were talking about the fossil record, that the supposed transitions from a land mammal to a whale had these famous ones that they keep putting in Newsweek and Time and having on the news, the Ambulocetus and Pachycetus, that are supposedly whale transitions. Archaeopteryx, the mammal-like reptiles. There are a few of these creatures that they can use to suit their purposes. But what we need to remember is that just because there are things that get discovered in the fossil record that can be considered intermediates, per se, that doesn't mean that they necessarily developed from an evolutionary, you know, descent with modification scenario. I mean, similarity, you know, there can be similarities of things, and if they discover more extinct varieties of animals, they can put them in places where they might think that they fit in terms of an evolutionary scenario. But it's just back to the Corvette analogy. Just because something has similarities, it doesn't imply or doesn't prove that it's that there's an evolutionary relationship there. just because we find something that can be put in an intermediate place. That's something that is still, there's still going to be a leap of faith or a jump to make that conclusion, Steve. That does happen a lot in the Scopes trial in Dayton in 25. That happened. A lot of the evidence that was used then as the best supporting evidence for evolution has been discredited now. The Nebraska man, Piltdown man. That doesn't tell the whole story. I don't want to distort it and make a straw man about what they can put together for evidence. But it does prove your point that, you know, when they make big claims about a little bit of evidence, a lot of times, with time, it turns out to be something that they have to revise or retract. And then you don't hear that much about that. That happened recently with the National Geographic when they put the supposed dinosaur with feathers on there. I can't remember the name of it, but it was discredited because it became obvious that it was a fraud, and I can't remember how they discovered that. But they had already put it out there on National Geographic, and later experts, you know, critiqued that and showed that it was, I can't remember if it was a Chinese scientist or somebody who had taken two different things and put them together and tried to make the claim that it was a transition. So it was probably within the last couple of years, something like that. But that kind of thing happens when there's such pressure to find these transitional forms, these intermediate forms that will fit the fossil record. But see, if you look at the Archaeopteryx or the Mammalite reptiles, I mean, they got like a handful of things. But what we're talking about, what there should be is literally billions of them. I mean, you shouldn't be able to classify things. You know, evolution says that there's a continuum. And all we see everywhere is discontinuity. In the present, you go to the zoo, you've got discontinuity between things. And their explanation is, well, the intermediate forms became extinct. You know, they were outcompeted, so they're not here anymore. Go to the fossil record, they're not there. There's discontinuity. So there's discontinuity everywhere. And then there's discontinuity in your imagination, trying to imagine how did these things evolve, step by step, gradually, by mutations and natural selection. How did we get from a squirrel to a bat? Something that could fly from a mammal that didn't fly. How did it survive in between when it didn't quite have a wing, but it was starting to have a flap? Well, it couldn't even get up the trees as well. It couldn't get away from its predators as well. So, and then you've got to have the right mutations occurring to carry that proto-flap onto a final wing, and yet those mutations are not directed by anything. It's just random chance. Just whatever happens genetically, whatever genetic errors happen, so they have to come on time, and they have to always be giving that critter an advantage so that it can reproduce better, leave more offspring of whatever trait it's developing. And yet, so you can't even imagine these intermediate transition forms. And that's what, so these little Archaeopteryx and these little handful of intermediate, don't let them intimidate you with those things and make out like they've got this great wealth of evidence supporting, because the big picture is they don't have nearly what they need to demonstrate evolution. They've got these huge discontinuities, huge gaps where there should be intermediates of all kinds, intermediates in structures, you know. You've got to have an intermediate sequence of development of an eye. You've got to have wings. You've got to have lungs and all the major organs. How did those things survive? You have to believe that somehow there was, that those intermediates did exist, because if you're believing in the, you know, Richard Dawkins version of evolution, where everything has to be gradual, step by step by step, then they had to be there. But where are they? And that's what we need to exploit, not let them get us off on the few supposed transitional forms or intermediate forms that they can claim that fit their theory. I mean, with the hundreds of thousands of animals in the world and plants, I mean, you would think that the evolutionists would be able to find some things that would fit their theory, correct? I mean, it's not a surprise that there's going to be some evidence that they can make conform to their way of looking at things. So that shouldn't get us off track, that there are certain things evidentially that fit with evolution. I mean, it is a story that can be told about the evidence, and it's consistent with that. But it's not the only story that can be told. I heard an account that I'm going to see if I can tell it. I don't know if I can tell it correctly, but it's similar to this type scenario. This idea that, yes, the evidence is consistent with the story you're telling, but it's not the only way of explaining it, nor the best way of explaining it. It'll be like you're in an arena, like an RBC center or something, and you walk in there and you notice a big target on the roof, and another bullseye target on one of the seats in these thousands of seats, and another target on another seat. And then you look more closely and you see an arrow stuck right in the bullseye of one of those seats, just right slap dab in the middle. And then a friend walks in and says, "Hey, how you doing? See, you're looking at my handiwork, seeing what I did." And he's coming in, he's got a bow in his hand, and he says, "Yeah, what happened was I turned the lights off and I spun around and I shot randomly the arrow and it went right into the bullseye. And I even did it several times in a row and did the same thing." Now, you might believe the guy, or you might say, I don't really believe what you're saying. He's saying, "What are you talking about? I'll prove it to you. You see, I've got the bow in my hand." And then he takes you over to the light switch and says, "See, I can turn the light switches on and off. And look, what is this? It's a target with an arrow in it. See? What more proof do you need?" And that's the way that they're using the evidence. Like they cite pieces of evidence that are consistent with the story that they're saying, but it's not the only story that you can tell about that evidence, and it's not the one that you're most likely to be inclined to think is the right story. But that's how they can deal with the evidence. So, yes, Shelley. And one of the funny things is that, at least in America, maybe America is the only civilized nation that's like this, but we've resisted accepting evolution in large part. Now, I know it's dominating in terms of the academic, intellectual world, the people who run the universities and who have control of the science machinery, you know, the National Academy of Sciences and the people who review journals and who hold conferences and so on and so forth. The research scientists at the universities, they are evolutionists by and large. Although there are people who, you know, say no. There are professional scientists who more and more are saying that, you know, we don't know what we think we've known. And they're entertaining intelligent design and other things like that. But in America, and people like Richard Dawkins who come from Europe, they're struck by that there's so many people in America that will not bend and accept evolution, like they just think that they should be compelled to do. You know, he's a full-blown atheist. He's very confident in it. If you ever hear him talk or interview, it's just amazing how bold and proud he is of his atheism. And, you know, he's like a fundamentalist preacher for evolution. That's kind of what he is. You know, he's just like a fundamentalist, naturalistic evolutionist is what he is. And he's going after it. You know, his most recent book, The God Delusion, is all about that, where he's talking about basically, you know, Christians are just lame brains who've invented God because they're weak and so on and so forth. You know, the typical story. And but in America, a lot of people resist it. 90% of Americans don't accept the standard view of evolution in the most recent poll, something like that, maybe 85 to 90%. You know, a lot of those are people who say evolution was God-directed, you know, theistic evolution of some sort, but they don't accept the party line that there is no God involved, evolution is purposeless, mechanistic, all that. They just will not buy into that. So other parts of the world may not be that way, but at least among Americans, there's this resistance to it. And as people like Philip Johnson points out, you know, maybe the powers that be in terms of the evolutionists should take the qualms that people have seriously. You know, is it likely that 90% of Americans could just be holding to something totally irrationally with no basis at all? Or is it more likely that they have legitimate reasons and concerns, but that the evolutionists simply won't entertain, they won't deal with it honestly? You know, they just want to shut it out and not talk about it and not deal with the controversy and say that those people are just ignorant, uninformed, and we're not even going to debate them or talk about them. We don't want to give any legitimacy to them. And so they try to perpetuate their position of strength by just ignoring or shutting them out and not even listening to their arguments, or creating straw man views of them, making them sound like they're just religious people who have no reason for rejecting evolution except their commitment to the Bible or something like that. So, but it is interesting that, you know, yeah, there are lots of intelligent people, but there are a tremendous number of intelligent people who don't accept it and have good reasons. It's not just, we haven't even talked about the biblical reasons why all this stuff's wrong. We're just looking at scientific-based problems that need to be known, that don't get to be shown. You know, this, none of these things are going to be mentioned in this textbook for, you know, high school biology or in college biology. Usually they're not going to talk about that. They're simply going to assert it very confidently. This is the way it is. We know this. Religious people believe that, but we know this scientifically. They're always doing it that way. And so they create in the minds of people this idea that we have a level of certainty that is just, I mean, evolution is a fact. Even though all these problems can be pointed out and should be pointed out, and we need to be aware of them. Okay, 10:20, so we've got about 10 more minutes. Peppered moths and Darwin's finches. Let's look at those together because they have some of the same issues. Peppered moths and Darwin's finches. He says, why do textbooks use pictures of peppered moths camouflaged on tree trunks as evidence for natural selection? And biologists have known since the 80s that moths don't normally rest on tree trunks, and all the pictures have been staged. And then Darwin's finches. Why do textbooks claim that beak changes in Galapagos Island finches during a severe drought can explain the origin of species by natural selection, even though the changes were reversed after the drought ended and no net evolution occurred? Both of those are examples of minor variation that is clearly observed. Natural selection, if you will. We accept natural selection when it's understood correctly. So what's the big deal? Peppered moths, you know, you start out with dark-colored ones and light-colored ones, and something causes the tree color to change so that a certain variety of those gets picked off by the birds more consistently than the other. And so the population shifts in terms of its light-colored and dark-colored varieties. But then if the trees change back because we enact laws that prevent, you know, pollution from discoloring the trees, then it shifts back the other way. Natural selection, yes. You know, birds are naturally selecting the ones that they can see. But what do you have at the end of the process? The same peppered moths that you started with. It's just a fluctuation in the varieties within that same group. But you haven't taken a moth and turned it into a bird or something else, which is the big claim. You know, that's the big problem, is the information that is required to get from a moth to something else. There's a lot of information. Or to get from a bacteria to a human being. You've got to have all the 100,000 additional genes telling the instructions or the information to get an eye and an intestinal system and a heart and a complex human brain and limbs and legs and a backbone and everything else. Where did all that information come from? That's what we're saying natural selection is not able to do. It can't produce an increase in information. And there's a tremendous amount of information that has to be obtained to get from a simple organism to a more complex one. Same with Darwin's finches. The beak varieties of the 14 or 15 species on the islands are interpreted as having come from an original mainland finch, and then they diversified and fit into different niches in the island, and so they no longer interbreed with one another, and so you get different species, supposedly, that are developing from a mainland species. Again, minor variation and a loss of information. You know, the different varieties of beaks that are present on the islands now were all that genetic information was there from the start in the original stock finch. And so because different environmental conditions are prevalent in one location, and that particular variety of finch does well and is successful and is able to pass its genes on to the next generation. And so that variety of long beaked finches or a certain coloration or whatever becomes dominant in that area. Perhaps it becomes the only kind in that area. The other ones die out because they can't compete and survive there. You can think of it in many other instances. Polar bears, you know, the bears that are, you know, thick-haired and light-colored are able to sneak up on their prey more easily in a snowy environment. Black bears don't do very well at that. So they all die off. And so you end up getting polar bears in polar regions from an original bear kind. There's a loss of information. The gene pool, the population of bears is reduced such that polar bears are not going to, you know, their offspring are not going to be black bears anymore. But way back in the past, there was probably a bear kind that had the genetic potential for all of those varieties. But all those varieties can't exist in certain environments. So you get specialization, a loss of information. It's a loss of genetic information, not an increase. And that's the big deal in this evolution issue for us, is they're not, by showing us, you know, finches, beaks changing, fluctuating because droughts and so forth, and then going back, or moths changing, or anything else like that. You know, any kind of minor change from this little insect that changes color. You know, we get several varieties, and then there's two colors, and they mate at a different time of the year, but they basically look the exact same. That's the kind of supposed evolutionary evidence that's like evolution in action. We can actually see it happening. What do you mean you don't believe in evolution? It's right here in front of your eyes. We can show it to you. Look at these finches. They're changing like this. That's what they want to do, is try to batter us with this idea that we can see evolution happening. But we don't dispute that. We don't have a problem with that, because none of those things are increasing the information, increasing, changing one kind of an animal into another kind, which is what the biblical problem would be with evolution in the first place, that it's an attack on a claim of Scripture that says that God created animals according to their kind and they were to reproduce after their kind. We don't know exactly where those kinds are. There may have been one cat kind that produced tigers and cheetahs and lions and whatever else, you know, based on the shuffling and reshuffling and recombination of that genetic material, but no new genetic material has been produced. No new information has occurred. There's just been a shuffling out and a specialization of different things based on the environments that they live in. Getting away from predators and being good predators has allowed those certain features to become accented in certain areas. And so, natural selection, yes. Variation within limits, yes. Increase of information, no. You know, no major morphological changes that produce a winged creature from a non-winged creature. That's an increase in information. So all these examples of supposed evolution in action, just realize the big problem with that. Understand the big issue with that. And that's what these peppered moths and Darwin's finches represent. Does that make sense? Okay. Scott. I've only heard of mutations that can be favorable, but they reduce the information content. For example, a type of beetle that has wings, that lives in an island ocean environment or close to an ocean environment. If they have wings, they tend to get swept off the island into the ocean. The wings pick up the wind and they get blown in the ocean more frequently. So they die more frequently, the ones with wings. So the variety, a mutant variety that lost their ability to produce wings, survives more and reproduces their offspring more, and so they become the dominant variety. That's a loss of information. They didn't gain information for making wings. They lost information, but it was a mutation that led to the loss of information, and there was a mutation in that sense was favorable. So we can talk about favorable mutations, but they're not increasing the information. Because if you think about it, a mutation is taking a complex thing that works together, you know, the genetic information, instructions for building proteins and structures and so forth, and I take this and I take it and stick it in my oven and melt it, is it going to work better? No, it's not. Or if I smash it on the ground, it's not. That a genetic error, you know, a mutation is a genetic mistake, a copying error in those instructions that tell something how to build this protein or this structure. And so we don't see that happening. We don't see mutations doing that. I think Richard Dawkins was asked in an interview, he wasn't prepared to answer this question because he didn't think that the person who was interviewing him was sympathetic to intelligent design or whatever. But the person asked him, can you give me one structure that is an example of an increased information as a result of evolution or mutation? And he just sat there and he just looked and he didn't say anything and he looked away. And he claims later that he realized at that point that, okay, this person is an intelligent design person or creation person, which I didn't know. And that's why he paused. But he never was able to provide a single example. The fact is, it wasn't doctored or anything. This video that shows this interview, he just sits there and can't cite a single example of increase in information being produced by any evolutionary mechanism or by mutation, which makes sense because of what mutations are. They just simply, it would be illogical for me to produce, you know, to be working on a document in Word and a lightning bolt hit my computer and all of a sudden a new paragraph appear or something that's not what I had in the original. It might garble it. I might lose my document, but it's not going to increase the information there. It's not likely to. They might believe that it can do that. They do believe that it can do that. They believe that natural selection, working on that mutation, will eventually increase the information. That's what they have to believe. They have to believe that mutations can produce new information, as long as you have natural selection to pick out the favorable stuff as it's going along. We dispute that. We say that you can't get that. You can't get these intermediate forms. You know, you're trying to get to a wing. How do you get to that wing when it's not a wing yet? How are the genes for a proto-flap wing going to be preserved when it's not advantageous yet? There's no selective advantage for that organism. So why would natural selection preserve it? It can't see ahead because it's undirected. It's mechanistic. There's no God directing it. So how it can't see ahead that it wants to become a wing. So it's just a random, completely not predictable process whenever that error occurs, and it's got to be the right error. You know, if they've gotten to protoflaps now, it can't be a different error that reduces their, you know, ability to have a thick fur or something else. It's got to be something that leads on in the right sequence to the final structures that they want. And so we would dispute that mutations do what they claim that they do. They believe that they do them. They haven't demonstrated that they do them. And that's what we need to go after them. And we need to go after them theoretically that it seems almost always to be the case in the real world that information is never increased by non-intelligent processes. We don't observe it anywhere. We don't observe it in the human world, in the computer science world. We don't see information coming from random, you know, non-intelligent sources. It's the removal of that noise that creates information. And so it doesn't therefore surprise us that when we look at DNA and the information content there that, you know, it, to our experiential way of looking at the world, that's consistent with a designer, with a intelligent cause, not with the belief that natural selection and mutations could produce that. That's a belief. Okay, well, we're done time-wise, and I think we've pretty much covered most of the sheet. We didn't get to a couple of them there, but hopefully you can see. I would highly recommend that you guys get this book and read it. It's a high school level reading, but it's so good. I think Philip Johnson does a good job of explaining why the world is the way it is in terms of the evolutionary, like the success. Why are so many scientists still evolutionists in spite of negative criticism? It's their commitment to naturalism. He explains it, and it's just a really helpful book. It's helpful for young people, so I highly recommend that. There's a lot of other good resources too, but I just really felt like that book does a good job. And you need, you know, if you want to be able to ask these kind of questions, you really need, you know, you can't get it from just talking about it in a class or two. You're going to have to study some, get some good DVDs and books, and kind of get your thought processes more filled out with these ideas so that you can talk about them. But let me close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, we again bow before You and acknowledge that You are the one true and living God. We thank You that there's tremendous, tremendous indication in the world around us and in Your Word of Your complete trustworthiness, Your complete truthfulness. You haven't led us astray. So much in Your Word telling us who You are, what You're like, what You require of us, and also what You've done in history. The evidence is just enormous. And we thank You for that. We thank You that our faith is not unreasonable or irrational, but we also thank You, dear God, that You have been merciful to us to open our eyes so that we would not be blind, that we would not think wrongly about what You've done in the world and turn natural things into gods. We're thankful, dear God, that You have enabled us to see the truth. We pray that we would be humbled by that, but that we would be diligent, that we would love You with all of our minds, and figure out ways to help those around us who perhaps maybe are persuaded by some of these things. Help us to be able to help them, to love them enough to give them the truth in a way that would help them and not just push them away further. Pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.